no penalties here. It's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show podcast with Drew Mindell, Ezra Ginsberg, and Dave Manute.
Saturday morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. As you can see, we're pleased to be joined on the program by Justin Cuthbert of Yahoo Sports. He covers the NHL. I am your host, Drew Mindell. Dave Manute also with me. Justin, good morning. Nice to see you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure, Justin. Obviously brought you on. Talk a little bit about the Stanley Cup playoffs. Talk about the North Division. Talk about the Winnipeg Jets. And let's start with the Jets because they are the hometown team here. I got to say, I love your background there. What is that, a Messier and a Lemieux there?
Yeah.
Messier and Lemieux, yeah. I pride myself on making this corner as look as good as it can, I guess.
And that is a quality corner you got going on there. From your perspective, Justin, I'm sure you've spent a lot of time watching all the series that have happened in the North Division, and of course that includes the Jets sweep of the Edmonton Oilers. What was your biggest takeaway, if you will, from the Jets 4-game victory over the Oilers?
I mean, I think it was shocking for me, like it was for probably most people outside of Winnipeg who might not have been paying as much attention to what the Jets were doing. But to me, it was a major surprise because we saw, how the Winnipeg Jets limped into the series, how they didn't play their best over the last, probably 6 weeks, 2 months. But when you dive into the numbers of those last 6 weeks, they seem to be transitioning to something similar to what they wanted to show the Edmonton Oilers, which was cutting down on events, trying to be a defensively responsible team. And it didn't really work for them as they limped down the stretch, but everything that they were sort of planning for, it seems, all of a sudden worked. Not to say that they dominated the series by any means, but they were able to solve what is really a pretty rudimentary puzzle, which is you shut down those two best players. If you can play strong defense against those two, well, it opens up a world for you outside of those 20 to 25 minutes that Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl are going to play. So, it's not what the style of play didn't exactly suit how I think the Jets are built. I mean, they're not a dominant defensive team in terms of personnel, but if you commit to something and if you commit to and everybody's on board and it's pretty well understood what the intentions are, you can beat a team that doesn't exactly have all that strength throughout its lineup and relies exclusively on two guys.
Justin, we're still waiting to find out who the Jets' opponent will be in the next round. Of course, that game six is tonight in Montreal. What do you see? How do you see this series playing out? Do you see that Montreal's gaining momentum?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm not sure that that game wasn't more of an anomaly, but I do find it almost interesting that the Leafs are in the position that they're in, or Montreal's in the position that it's in, because really, the Canadians have gotten exactly what they wanted in this series, which is to shut down Auston Matthews, to use Phil Deneau, Shea Weber, and Ben Chiarot to limit all the damage, just like a Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid, from that number one line with Auston Matthews and Mitch Marner. Only one goal between them, only really one good game between them out of five. So that brings it to a battle of the depth. And if you look at the depth, it should favor Montreal. I mean, you've got Nick Suzuki outside of that, Anderson out of that top line. You got Tyler Toffoli, who scored a bunch of goals this year outside of that top line. Jesperi Kotkaniemi, like, they've got a pretty good solid depth after that top unit, which is doing its job. And then you compare that to what the Leafs have, and it's okay. William Nylander's playing out of his mind. That's great. He's been able to. It's probably been the difference in the series. John Tavares isn't here anymore. Okay, so who else is there? Alex Kerfoot, he stepped up, but Alex Kerfoot versus Nick Suzuki, like, you like that matchup, right? And then you go all the way down the list, and all of a sudden you're at Jason Spezza pretty quickly, because guys like Thornton, Simmons, Mikheyev, they're not really doing anything for you offensively. They can shut down another line. But if this is turned into a battle of the depths, and it's, you can take Phil Deneau and Auston Matthews and create a wash, I think Montreal would be in this series, and they certainly are. But maybe they haven't forced their way as much as you maybe think they should by the way that they've shut down Matthews and Marner.
Justin Cuthbert is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Saturday morning. Justin covers the NHL for Yahoo Sports. Obviously, Justin, tonight's game 6 back in Montreal, the first game in Canada that'll be in front of fans. I think it's probably overstating it to say that the fans themselves and, 2,500 of them will be a difference maker. But, just from an observer's standpoint, you know, won't it be refreshing to watch a game in Canada that has fans in the stands?
Yeah, definitely. And 2,500 fans, I'm not sure if they can actually compete with the crowd noise they pump into the Bell Center, because they do a pretty good job amplifying the sound in there. But, you know, we saw when there was just the start of fans being in the stands in the States that it did have a difference. Like, it created a bit of an atmosphere. It probably had an effect on the game and the players just a little bit. And I think it will to a certain extent. But I've heard that the tickets are like crazy prices, like $1,000 a pop. I think they would probably start with, excuse me, their families first. And the families can certainly make noise. But are the people that are willing to shell out $1,000 per ticket going to be as rowdy as maybe you need them to be, or as rowdy as we've seen in certain areas? I definitely think it'll be a help. I think it'll still feel incomplete, like these playoffs have felt throughout since the start of the season, really, for the North Division. But I think it'll give it a little extra pop. We might be bigging it up a little bit more than it'll actually be, but I certainly think it'll be a welcome sight. And for the 2,500 that get to be in attendance, I mean, kind of part of history, because it's been over 14 months, I think, since we've seen fans in the stands at a Canadian hockey game, and it'll be a refreshing sight to see, that's for sure.
Justin Cuthbert, our guest, Saturday morning. You're listening, you're watching, you're chatting with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Justin covers the NHL for Yahoo Sports.
Well, Justin, you know, in Winnipeg, there was celebration, but in Edmonton, there was a postmortem. So what was your big takeaway from things in Edmonton, and what the state of that franchise looks like right now?
Yeah, I mean, my big takeaway is that we basically can't even use the season's worth of data from them, because they're clearly a team that in a regular season, the guys, Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, can carry them and create them into something that they're really not. But if you look at the four games, and again, it wasn't like a whitewash and it wasn't complete dominance from the Jets, three overtime games, all very close. If you look at all the underlying data, it might suggest that the Oilers were the better team for the majority of it, which is, you know, certainly an argument. But other than Connor, Leon, and Darnell Nurse, who emerged as an absolute star this year and might make the Olympic team, I don't think they have anything beyond that. I really don't think they have anything to build on. Their best players beyond that would be Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, rather. And Tyson Barrie, you know, at least played good 5-on-5 minutes and ran the power play and put up a boatload of points. And they're going to be free agents. And, like, you just run down the line and it gets so thin so quickly. Now they're talking about bringing Mike Smith back, and that's fine. But this was an outlier season for him, and are you going to expect the same when he's turning 40 this year? It's only okay to bring back Mike Smith if you're not bringing back Mikko Koskinen, and he's got at least a year left, I think maybe two. So problems at every position, really, and problems that two of the best in the world can cover up when the games aren't quite as meaningful, when the Jets aren't quite fully committed to playing 100% defensively sound structure. That's not what you see in the regular season. It's not what you see from teams throughout the regular season, because that's just not how hockey is played in the regular season. The brand of hockey favors Connor and Leon and the Oilers in the regular season, but it flips and it changes, and they just don't have any answer when there's actual commitment to detail against those two guys and you're able to limit them. If you're expecting anyone else to win you a game in Edmonton, it's just not going to happen. So they need to make widespread changes to that roster. They're going to be bringing in some new guys. They have a ton of money to spend, but it's going to take an immense amount of creativity for them to get to the spot that they need to get to. And Ken Holland, despite his success, you don't think of him as a creative genius, and that's what they need. They need someone who's going to, you know, turn over every rock in order to find a small way to improve the roster. Like, I think about what the Penguins did with Jeff Carter. He's not, like, no one was thinking about that. No one thought they could bring on Jeff Carter at $5 million, but retained into that number three hole. Suddenly you got a Jordan Staal again. That's the type of stuff that works. And that's the type of creativity I've just not seen from the Edmonton Oilers ever. And I think Edmonton Oilers fans should be a little bit concerned that we might not see that this summer to the extent that we need to, because they need to do everything possible to get more talent around them.
Justin Cuthbert, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Saturday morning. You're watching, you're chatting, you're viewing the show on our YouTube channel and all of our social media platforms. You know, Justin, after the Jets dispatched the Oilers in four very close games, I found it very interesting the hand-wringing that was occurring about, you know, how the games are called in the playoffs and how the officiating standard changes from the regular season to the playoffs. And I don't necessarily disagree that that occurs, but, you know, why is anybody surprised, I guess, at this point in time that there are two different rule books in the NHL and that the powers that be within the league have no reason or have no impetus, it seems, to want to change that?
Yeah, I'm not really sure why people are surprised that this is happening, because we see it all the time. And I guess if you're going to ever inspire change, you need to continue to be loud about something or it's not going to happen. I think the more frustrating thing, because we kind of understand that it does change from the regular season to the playoffs, is that there seems to be inconsistency from series to series. Like, I watch, you know, I'm trying to watch as much as possible, but throwing on Carolina and Nashville, and it seems like there's a penalty, not every shift, but a good amount of time. There seems to be penalties going back and forth, maybe more for Carolina than Rod Brendamore was, you know, too excited about. But I just feel like it's impossible for Connor McDavid to go four games without drawing a penalty. It doesn't make any sense to me, at least unless no one's touching him. And clearly they were doing their best to get in his way at every turn. So that doesn't make too much sense to me. And there was only one penalty, I think, in game five between Montreal and Toronto, and it didn't play out that way. And I saw Riley Smith bury, I forget who it was, in front of the net when the game was still in the balance, game seven between Minnesota and Vegas, and there was no call, and that was a clear scoring chance. Like, that type of stuff doesn't make too much sense to me. I think you can limit the ticky-tack stuff, but when something literally eliminates a scoring chance or prevents what could be a scoring chance from developing, I think you have to call it by the book as close to possible. I get that you want to cut it down. You want the players to decide it five on five by themselves, have the referees stay out as much as possible. But in the process of trying to stay out of the game, they become more of the game. And that's really the problem.
I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Dave Manuk is with me. Our guest is Justin Cuthbert, Yahoo Sports NHL analyst. We're talking about the North Division. We're talking about the NHL playoffs. It is Saturday morning, the bottom of hour number two of the program.
You know, Justin, it's funny. We've been so focused. We've had such blinders here in Winnipeg on what's going on with the Jets and what's going on in the North Division. You kind of forget about the rest of the NHL. And we've talked to guys, and I said it's like covering the KHL. It may as well be a completely different league right now from what we're watching here in the North. But I think one of the things that I really kind of came to appreciate was that, and you talked about it a little bit in terms of the fans that are going to be in Montreal tonight. When I watched that overtime between Toronto and Montreal last game, versus the Carolina-Nashville overtime, what a disparity it was between having a full building versus not. And I was in the arena for the Jets triple overtime game, and there were maybe 50 of us in the building. It's such a different feeling versus what you see with fans. So what kind of lift? I know you said it won't match in terms of what the Bell Center, the type of noise they're bringing in, but how much of an impact is that going to have? And is that almost an unfair advantage in the sense that in Toronto, I believe they still can't have fans. Here in Winnipeg, we know they still can't have fans. But now they're in Montreal, they're going to allow them to have that fan base. So do you think that's going to create a bit of an unfair advantage in terms of, you know, the overall atmosphere for the home team?
Well, I don't know if Montreal is going to have a terribly huge advantage, but I know whichever Canadian team does go through and ends up in a different barn is going to be seriously disadvantaged just in the series alone. Like, it is a different world having 18,000 screaming half in the bag fans cheering on your team and chanting against you. I do frankly worry about whichever team that gets through is just going to, it's going to be like trying to catch up to 100-mile-an-hour fastball when you've been seeing changeups for the entire year. I think there's going to be a serious learning curve for either the Jets, the Leafs, or the Canadians when that team does get to that point. I've heard rumors of what might happen. I still think we're close to the deadline here from the Canadian government and the NHL talking until, I believe, June 1st. So it could be early this week when we actually know, but it doesn't really matter because at the end of the day, they're going to be playing in either a bland barn or a barn that is just trying to manufacture some sort of fan presence. And that fan presence might come from the other side. So I do think that I don't know if Montreal is going to have that much of an advantage in game six on Saturday night, because I think the Leafs will relish that. I think Leaf fans will get there as well. And maybe it's a bit of a wash with just some background noise. But when that first Canadian team steps into Colorado or Carolina or whatever it is, it's going to be a different experience and something that they're not used to, certainly because they haven't experienced it in the last 14 months. Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to lose the series or not or whatever, but I think that coupled with the fact that these teams that are playing in other divisions that are going to get through might be at a higher level than we know compared to what's going on in the Canadian division, at least at the top, it could be a rude experience for the first Canadian team that does get through and plays in those first two games, likely on the road. It's possible that Toronto is at home, but that would help. If they could get into the series before they have to go on the road, that would certainly be a benefit, because stepping in that first night is going to be a whole different world.
Last question for you, Justin. I mean, and to your point there about, you know, we've been, and Dave mentioned it earlier, you know, my focus, our focus, most of Canada's focus has been strictly on the North Division so far this year. Now, with the playoffs, you watch a little more hockey, you watch a little bit of what's going on in the other divisions. Looking at the Canadian teams left, the Jets, the Leafs, the Habs, you know, how do you think that, you know, they match up just watching it through your television set against some of those elite teams that are playing down south? I mean, Tampa and Carolina, those are two elite hockey teams. You know, Colorado and Vegas, we know those are two elite hockey teams. You underestimate the Bruins and the Islanders at your own peril. Still, you know, the attitude was that the North Division winner is going to be the weakest of the four. Have you seen anything that changes your mind to that effect?
I don't know if they'll be the weakest of the four. I definitely think they'll be in the bottom two. I mean, Colorado, Vegas, Carolina, and Tampa, I think, are sort of emerged as the best four teams in the playoffs. And it's sort of unfortunate that they're going to play each other here. But it shows, you know, displays the fact that we're going to get some good series in the second round. Mm-hmm. What it also shows, I think the Canadian teams would be able to compete. I mean, Nashville gave Carolina problems, and I think Carolina is a legitimate Stanley Cup contender. But when I do think they get to that point, if they have to match up with one of those teams, it's going to be very difficult. I think Colorado is sort of on a different level. I think Vegas is close and they're going to make it a series, and maybe they're going to make it seem like, okay, maybe that disparity isn't that big because, hey, Colorado might be pushed in the second round. But I think Tampa is showing that professional, you know, postseason know-how. I think Carolina might be a little bit underneath the Tampa Bay Lightning in terms of talent, even though they outperformed them in the regular season. But if Toronto or Winnipeg, I don't think Winnipeg can drop Boston, but if Toronto and Boston play each other, I think it's going to be a series. If the New York Islanders play one of those teams, I think it's going to be a series. But if you get thrown in against Colorado in round one, which I think would be the case with the Jets, yeah, it would. I think they would have less points than the Islanders. So that would be a rude awakening. I think the best chance for a Canadian team to have success would be the Maple Leafs taking that number two or number three seed and having, you know, a seat at the table, at least against either Carolina or Tampa. But in any situation, I think the Canadian team in the third round will be seriously in the underdog status, I'll say.
Well, there's one team left to be determined for round two. That's between the Leafs and the Habs. Game six goes tonight. And if the Leafs lose that one, it'll be an epic hand-wringing for game seven come Monday night back in Toronto. Justin Cuthbert covers the NHL for Yahoo Sports. Justin, appreciate your time. Appreciate your insight. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
A lot of fun, guys. Enjoy the game tonight.
Take care. There he goes, Justin Cuthbert of Yahoo Sports joining us here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Dave Minuk, let's keep our look going at round two from the Winnipeg Jets perspective. I should mention, of course, first that this segment is brought to you by Boston Pizza. Boston Pizza has the perfect starting lineup tonight with the BP Game Day Meal Deal. Choose two of your favorite medium gourmet pizzas like the Spicy Pierogi and the Mighty Meteor, along with a triple order of Boston's famous wings, all for $54.99. It serves 5 to 6 people. Available for takeout and delivery only at bostonpizza.com or download the MyBP app. So we talked about the forward matchup, Dave, and you look at the defense matchup for the Winnipeg Jets, and I think that much like we've seen, you know, for the most part this year against the Leafs, maybe a little less so against the Habs, but the Jets defense will be considered a little bit weaker than their opponent in round number two. You know, maybe the bottom pairing for the Habs concerns me because for whatever reason, Dominic Ducharme has not been using Alexander Romanov this playoffs, even though I think he's better than both John Merrill and Eric Gustafson. But that's, you know, a separate issue altogether. But I think what the Jets defense has shown in round one is that, you know, if they continue to play with that five-man unit that we saw have such success oftentimes against the Oilers, they can mitigate whatever weaknesses, whatever perceived weaknesses they do have on the back end.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think we talked about that through the course of this program. I think that people wanted to pile on the Jets D and say that, you know, they stunk and that they're no good and they can't hold their own. And that, I guess that's a fair take that you can have. It's not necessarily an accurate one. And I think we saw that because the Jets were no longer playing like two defensemen and three forwards on a line. And and the forwards were supporting the defense. And when you have that happen, when you have, like Murat said in the first segment of the show, or the first hour of the show, sorry, you know, four guys on the line, the team's backing each other up. You know, you're not leaving guys hanging out to dry. You're not weak back checking. Well, that's a huge benefit to your defense. And so we've seen guys, Logan Stanley stepped up. You know, he's getting penalty kill minutes in the Stanley Cup playoffs. And I really just, I was thinking back to a conversation we had when we were still on the radio during a call-in segment, and someone asked if Logan Stanley was a bust. And I said, no, he's not a bust. I said, you know, he's a project. He's the player who's going to take some time. Yeah. Now, and I always had faith he'd be an NHLer. I mean, I'm not suggesting that I had some sort of great insight. I just watched him in the AHL. I felt like he would eventually make the transition. I will not pretend to think that I had any thought that he was going to do what he did. I thought he'd get into some games. I thought he'd be a semi-regular. I didn't think he'd establish himself the way he has. So, and that's on him. That's on the good work he did. Paul Maurice was asked about it in media availability this week, and he said it was a lot of it he felt was what he did over the summer, a lot of the training he did with Mark Scheifele, a couple of Kitchener guys training together. So, and I think that's one of the things that we weren't expecting. And I was thinking to the idea of, Logan Stanley, the hit on Josh Archibald levels and Logan Stanley being the difference. And I thought to myself, if you would have told me Logan Stanley would be the reason the Jets end up defeating the Edmonton Oilers, I wouldn't have believed it. But
for interrupting you. And I meant to bring this up earlier in the show when you mentioned the Archibald hit. I mean, look, Archibald hit obviously had a huge impact on game three, but I don't think you can overstate the impact it had on game four. With Archibald being suspended and being out of the lineup, that meant that Dave Tippett, when he was running his bench during the third overtime, and I thought he did a pretty lousy job at running his bench, you know, only relying on basically, you know, six forwards. Had Archibald been in the Oilers lineup for that game four, he would have been relied on. So again, the hit on Stanley obviously gave the Jets a boost in game three. But you can't underestimate the impact it had on game four as well, particularly in the overtime periods where Dave Tippett didn't have any other options that he trusted. Prior to the hit on Stanley or the attempted wounding on Stanley, Tippett trusted Archibald. Take him out of the lineup, and you saw that Tippett just didn't have anybody that he trusted for that overtime period, and that's another player out of their rotation when your rotation is pretty thin to begin with.
Yeah, and
I just wanted to get that in there.
No, and I think it's good. I think it's a completely valid point. I just think, like I said, nobody would have anticipated that Logan Stanley, Tucker Pullman, which is exactly where I've said Tucker Pullman should be playing, is your third pairing defenseman, and Forbert and Pionk, those guys have a lot of familiarity, and then you got Morrissey and DeMello. So right now, this Jets defense, nobody's saying that they're a top defense in the NHL, but when the forwards are playing collectively like they could, like they did, if they commit in that manner, I mean, if they have that mindset, and there's no reason to think that they won't, will they be perfect in it? Absolutely not. You know, people are human, they make mistakes. But with that mindset, when you see that you can win games that way, it's not the prettiest always, but when you can see that you've got the best goaltender or one of the best goaltenders in the NHL, and you have a mindset, a game plan, a blueprint for how to have success. And don't think they're not watching these games against the Montreal Canadiens and the Toronto Maple Leafs and seeing how Matthews and Marner's have been limited. You know, we heard Justin talk about it. One goal in five games. That
only for Matthews. Marner's still, I mean, I think I saw a stat. It's been 16 playoff games since Mitch Marner last scored a goal. I mean, that is hard to believe. That's an anomaly way more than it is, I think, anything else. But you remember the criticism that Nikolaj Ehlers took before he could score in the playoffs. And we know that's obviously not an ongoing issue after he scored in overtime in game three and was certainly impactful once he returned to the Jets lineup. But, you know, Mitch Marner has got to be feeling pressure for the Toronto Maple Leafs, having not been able to score a goal in, like I said, whatever it was, 16 or so games since he last scored in the playoffs for the Leafs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And if you don't have your top guns going and your depth isn't producing, well, you're in trouble. And you're getting good goaltending, which is obviously, we've seen that with the Jets sometimes when there's guys who aren't necessarily, you know, getting it done. But I think what we've seen from this Jets team collectively is that you can get offense from any of those top three lines, realistically. And obviously, Matthew Perreault, when he gets onto the second power play unit, or 1A, 1B line, a power play. But I think what it comes down to for the Jets, because it was going to be the big question mark, would have been collective team defense and individually how these defensemen would step up their game and play. And we've seen Josh Morrissey, you know, he's getting rave reviews for what he was able to do. And people could lament the fact that there weren't penalties called, but for the most part, it went both ways. I mean, Connor McDavid, for sure there was interference on him, but there were other times where I was in the building, I'm watching, I saw things happening. I thought to myself, how's that not a penalty? You know, there was a delay of game that wasn't called. That was clearly a delay of game. Like, there are a lot of instances where the refs put the whistles away and allow the game to like unfold in front of them as opposed to trying to manage it.
I think it is a little silly that the standard of officiating changes from period to period, game to game, and series to series. But you know who can stop that or who can demand changes to it? And it's not, by the way, the columnists who all of a sudden jumped out of their chairs to you know, lament that McDavid and Draisaitl were being hooked and hollered. It's the general managers of the NHL. Any change that happens in the NHL starts with the general managers. It starts with the presidents of the franchises. It starts with the team. So, you know, every time somebody writes, and God help them, stop writing about it, find something better to do to write about, you know, the fact that there's 3-point games in the NHL. Yeah, we know there's 3-point games in the NHL. We know that it doesn't make any sense that, you know, 3 points are awarded in game A and only 2 points are awarded in game B. Mm-hmm. The horse is out of the barn until the league and the general managers want to change it. And it's the exact same with the officiating standard. You want consistent officiating? It starts with the general managers saying, we demand officiating to be standard X. Not standard X when it suits their team and mm-hmm. standard X when it suits their franchise the most. That's where the change will happen. It will not happen with columnists. It will not happen with hand-wringing and woe is me, look what happened to poor McDavid and Draisaitl. Ken Holland wants to get a better standard of officiating, then Ken Holland needs to get on the phone with his other 31 general managers and come together as a unified front. Then it will change. It will not be the columnists, no matter how much pressure they are adding or think that they are putting on the NHL, because I can promise you the NHL gives all of zero damn about what any of the columnists are saying when it comes to officiating.
Yeah, there's no question.
Sorry, I had to get that off my chest.
Yeah, that clearly, Drew, you had some fire. You had to unleash it. You had to unleash that fireball, which is good because Seagram's is a sponsor of the illegalcurve.com website, a supporter of the show. So, I mean, the fireball is rolling through Drew right now. And you know, it's funny because when you were going on your little screed there, I was thinking about when we had Bill Daly on the show years ago, and I asked him, I think it was the idea of 3-point games to kind of really remove, you know, this false parity in the league. And he tried to be like, well, what do you mean? What are you talking about? The league it's fine. And I thought to myself, okay, sure it is.
He knows they are. I mean, these guys aren't foolish. They haven't become, they haven't achieved the standards that they've achieved in their career because they're stupid people. They know exactly what's going on. And if they wanted to change it, they would change it. There is no overwhelm. You know why general managers don't want it changed? because a general manager likes to go to their boss and say, hey, boss, we were only 4 points out of the playoffs. You know, we're right there. We were really close. When in the reality is they only won less than 50% of their games outright. And the only reason they're close is because of the nonsense. It works for general managers. The reason why eventually we're going to see a play-in series like we're seeing in the NBA is because it works for general managers and it helps coaches and GMs keep their jobs. That's why these guys are self-interested. They're not, you know, Ken Holland and Kevin Cheveldayoff and, every general manager in the NHL, Ron Hextall in Pittsburgh, these guys are first and foremost self-interested.
For the record, that just sounds wrong.
I know it does. They're first and foremost self-interested in what keeps them employed, what's best for the league and for the greater good of hockey as this wonderful ideal. I mean, they're human beings. They want to keep a paycheck coming in.
Yeah, there's no question about it. So, anyways, let's move off of the let's get back to the if you want. I mean, people in the comment section, right? Led Floydian saying, how many times did we see Mike Smith handle the puck in the penalty zone? I counted at least two. There were lots of instances. Now, you know, I think Jeff Vallette on Twitter posted that the top players in the league are not drawing penalties.
Right.
You know, they're getting a lot of obstruction, a lot of hooking, a lot of whatever. But again, that's kind of the standard that the NHL has allowed. And so to your point, Drew, and let's just wrap it up here. Unless the GMs make a huge push, you can tweet all you want. Tweets aren't going to do anything.
No, they're not. You're absolutely right that it doesn't, you know, when you look at every other league, you know, you look at the NBA, you look at the NFL, they protect their superstars. Does it make sense to me that the NHL doesn't protect their superstars and allows what I'm going to call lesser players, lesser talented players to get away with a lot of nonsense? Of course it doesn't make any sense. Right. But the general managers like it because guess what? There's only a few superstars. Most teams don't have superstars, and most teams can't survive against superstars when without the clutching and the grabbing and the hooking. And so those general managers are only interested in their self-interest and their self-preservation, not in making things better for McDavid and Draisaitl. Because guess what? They don't have a McDavid and Draisaitl, so they don't give a damn. That's the reality of the situation. That's the whining of the columnists, the complaining is just, you're screaming into the ether. You're screaming into the void. Save your column inches and become a general manager if you want to make some changes to it. That's how you can change. You make change from the inside. It's not going to change from external forces. Okay. We're done with that now. Let's shift our focus, Dave Minuk, to goaltending and special teams and coaching ahead of round two between the Jets and the question marks. We don't know who that's going to be yet, but time will tell. That segment, that before we get to that, the segment of the show is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for over 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. Bernstein's undergoing a little bit of renovations. Hot food not currently available, but they got their great sandwiches. They got their great salads. You yourself can go to Bernstein's Deli, buy all the ingredients, take them home, and make your own Illegal Curve sandwich in the comfort of your home, because Bernstein sells all the good stuff. They sell the thick-cut rye bread you need. They sell the chicken schnitzel. They sell the salami. Maybe they'll throw in some fried onions. I'm not sure. They got some honey mustard I'm sure you can buy. Head to Bernstein's Deli. That's where you need to go. Get all your good stuff. Get yourself a nice Illegal Curve sandwich or a salad or a soup or some deli or some knishes, whatever you want. Bernsteinsdeli.com for more information.
I actually got an email from someone, from a viewer, saying asking about the Illegal Curve sandwich and whether it was why it was off the menu. And I said, obviously we have to. You have to listen to the commercials. Right now, you don't have that option. But to Drew's point, you can pick up the materials necessary and make your own at home.
Breaking news update: Ezzy is rejoined the chat, and now he's on narcotics. So
why doesn't he just come in the show?
No, I'm sort of enjoying this. I like the vibe that you and I have going. We don't have to,
This is very post-gamey right now.
It is very post-gamey, as he usually can't necessarily stay up those late hours. But he's keeping things interesting in the chat, undoubtedly. And now that he's on some T3s, I hope you wash those down with some alcohol, Ezzy, because I can't see that being a bad problem at all. Or make sure you'll be really useful for your family later on during the course of the day. But in any event, we're glad that you have some medicine and that hopefully you're going to feel better and join us for the post-game show. We don't know when that's going to be. We know we're going to do post-game shows this week, God willing. Might be Tuesday, might be Thursday, might be Monday, might be Wednesday. We're not sure, but keep it tuned here to our YouTube channel. Subscribe. That way you get alerted each and every time we go live, be it with the Illegal Curve post game show or with the Illegal Curve hockey show. Make sure if for some reason you're not already doing so, follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve and our website with all the latest Winnipeg Jets news, audio. What's that website, Dave? Video too. What's that website?
Little website called illegalcurve.com.
There you go. Dave Minuk is a company man. The Jets, they're going to be hitting the practice ice in about 10 minutes time. Standard at this point in time, the last few days, they've been practicing. There hasn't been a lot of news coming out of those practices. Everyone has been healthy for the most part. Everyone's been on the ice. The Black Ace has come on the ice, about halfway through the practice. It is very much sort of Groundhog Day for the Winnipeg Jets this week, as it has been for most of us for the last, 14, 16, 18 months, however long it's been at this point in time. I can't keep track anymore. Let's talk about goaltending, Dave, because I think it's fascinating. Connor Hellebuck was fantastic for the Jets, as we know, in that first round against the Edmonton Oilers. The numbers, 950 save percentage, a 1.60 goals against average. The top goalie so far in the playoffs. Goalie number two, Jack Campbell of the Toronto Maple Leafs. 944 save percentage, 1.61 goals against average. Carey Price certainly hasn't been bad based on what I would describe as regular season numbers, but his 919 save percentage and his 2.66 goals against average ranks him as the 13th best goaltender so far in these small sample size NHL playoffs. I know there's a lot of people sort of concerned about the Jets and the Carey Price factor if it is the Jets and the Habs. But what's more concerning? What's the sort of the tougher goalie matchup? Is it Jack Campbell or is it Carey Price?
Well, I mean, I think the Jets have shown that they can get to both guys, right? I think I don't know that you have the fear of impossibility there. I don't think when Connor Hellebuyck is on his game, a lot of people think to themselves, okay, there's a guy who's setting up a wall and, go Jets 1.0 reference, a little Boolin Wall-esque against the Detroit Red Wings, many, many years ago in the playoffs. And
game
I think...
Still remember that game five and Delbel mark that game five and
Joe Louis 72 shots or something like that. It was something crazy. So yeah. I think Connor Hellebuyck is going to provide you that edge. I think that I touched on it earlier. I think Jack Campbell, the two Michigan boys who have a good friendship, a good relationship, that's definitely setting itself up for an interesting matchup if that's what it ends up being. And Carey Price is a big-time goalie. I mean, I think it was Justin who said, he's got the medals behind his name. He knows what it's like to win in big games. But I would still give the edge to the Jets. So ultimately, when it comes to goaltending, you have to like what the Jets have because this team has just had confidence. And I think, was it Marty Baron that we had on when he was stealing Wi-Fi during the regular season? And I asked him.
He was into the forest or something when that happened. Yeah.
And I asked him about, Jack Campbell and his feeling. And his thought was, will he be able to, his concern was health. And would he be healthy enough to shoulder the load of the playoffs? Well, so far he's shown that he's capable of doing that. Mm-hmm. And Frederik Andersen, who last I saw him was being lit up by the Manitoba Moose in the AHL on a conditioning assignment. He's still we're not entirely sure what his status is, but I think it comes down to, I can only really think of one goal that wasn't a particularly good one on Campbell so far in the playoffs. Now I haven't admittedly watched all the Leafs Habs series, so I can't say about all of the goals, but I would say that he's been very good for this Toronto team. I mean, you look at that number, Drew, the numbers don't lie.
Yeah. It's not that there's not a lot of falsehoods to those numbers. Now, he wasn't great in game five against the Habs, but Jack Campbell, here's what my comment would be. Carey Price in one game or Carey Price in the first round would terrify me, being the opponent. Carey Price has not been able to put it together for multiple series where he's backstopped the team, where he's been able to carry the team for a long, long time, for a number of years. If there was a one-gamer, Carey Price is terrifying to see at the other end of the ice. But you remember last year in the bubble, you know, he was great against the Pittsburgh Penguins. And so as a result, the Habs beat the Penguins unexpectedly, and they moved on to the first round of the playoffs. Well, then he wasn't as great anymore. Now, is that a factor of the team that's in front of him? Certainly, to some extent. I mean, the Habs are not a fantastic hockey team by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, Carey Price's just the inconsistencies that we've seen in his game are concerning to me from if I was a Habs fan, that he would be able to do it again in the second round of the playoffs. Jack Campbell, I know it's this, people keep saying small sample size. And that's legitimate. He hasn't done it for years. He hasn't done it, you know, throughout his career. His career has been one of ups and more downs. But he has done it for long enough this year in the regular season and for the most part in this playoffs that him against Hellebuck, I think, is a closer matchup than Carey Price against Connor Hellebuck. And I find it bizarre that I am saying those words, but I do believe that there's some truth to them.
Yeah, I made that point earlier, and I, you know, James Robinson says Hellebuck is on a mission. He wants to lift Lord Stanley's cup. We didn't say the cup part. I added that, but you know, and it's interesting, right? I think back to that preseason quote. I think it was preseason, you know, the season's all blended in. I think it was Ted Wyman asking in availability with Connor Hellebuck, you know, in terms of that idea of winning, personal accolades, winning a Vezina, winning whatever, you know, as you know, a Hart trophy as the most valuable player for the team. If he was going to do that. And we've said before that oftentimes Connor Hellebuck is no doubt this team's MVP. They wouldn't be where they are without him in net. And, you know, his point was there's only one thing he's focused on winning right now. So James, that was an accurate reflection of what Connor Hellebuck's sentiment is that it's not about the business. It's not about individual accolades. It's about winning that team award. So he seems dialed in. He seems like a guy who is focused on one thing right now, and that's pushing his team to success. And the one thing about Connor Hellebuck, and I've covered him since his AHL days, he doesn't really focus a lot on individual anyways. He really is a team guy. He talks about team success and he'll say, look, if he has a crap game, then we know what we get with Connor Hellebuck. You're going to get the positivity. Like, I like my game.
Look at the bright side stuff.
And it's funny, right? So when he's playing poorly, he still talks in a positive way. When he's playing well, it's still not really about him.
He'll say, if he ever gets a shutout, you know, what's his first comment? Well, the guys made it easy for me, and the guys in front of me made it easy. They kept everything on the outside. They cleared away any traffic. They cleared away any rebounds. He's certainly one to deflect success. I mean, you know, more often than not, which I'm sure is part of his psychological routine. And it's certainly, you know, I'm sure it plays well in the room and everything else. And I'm sure it's a combination. I mean, truthfully, he knows that a lot of it has to do with him. And I'm sure he takes a great amount of pride in his successes, and it takes a great amount of pride in his achievements. But at the same time, he is also very happy to defer praise to his teammates in front of him.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the point that I think of this segment, is that idea of that Connor Hellebuck, the way he's playing right now, he's your edge in any series, I think. And I think he can win a series on his own, but I think with the way, I mean, he can't score goals, of course, which is the one thing goaltenders, with the exception of a few, Marty Brodeur, you know, who's not, well, Ron Hextall, there's of course some goaltenders who tend to score goals, but I really think the way the Jets are playing in front of him, this is one of those instances where you can point to this team playing in front of him and saying they are playing well. So this team collectively is I think, to your point, Drew, it's one series. And it was a close series. It wasn't as if they steamrolled the Edmonton Oilers. So that's, of course, taken into account. But that's all we can do. All we can do is talk about what we've seen in front of us, not what may, you know, what could be. Well, I guess we could theorize, but we're trying to keep it focused on the here and now.
Let's take our final commercial break. Brian Engblom, our old friend, you remember from his Jets coverage, he's now with our friends in Tampa Bay, is set to join us momentarily. We'll be right back. You're listening, you're watching, you're chatting with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on YouTube and all of our social media platforms. Saturday morning, hour number 3 of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now. And there he is at the bottom of our screen, a good friend of ours, back from his Jets analyst days, now back in the sunny confines of South Florida. Brian Engblom joins us on the show. Brian, how are you? Good to see you, buddy.
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
We're doing fine and dandy, Brian. Obviously, brought you on this Saturday morning. Appreciate your time, of course. John, to talk about the Tampa Bay Lightning, to talk about round 2 coming up against the Carolina Hurricanes. Before we look forward, let's look back at what was the series victory against the Florida Panthers. I mean, Brian, is it as simple to say that the series was, the difference was Andre Vasilevsky and net for the Tampa Bay Lightning versus the Florida Panthers having to go through 3 different goaltenders, including rookie goalie Spencer Knight, to try and find somebody who can shut down the Lightning talent?
Yeah, that's certainly one of the stories. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You can't deny the statistics of the first 2 goalies that played for them. Vasilevsky's always just that guy for the Lightning. They depend on him a lot. They did last year in the playoffs. They did previous year's regular season. They did again this regular season. So they had an edge in goal. There's no doubt about that. It was a really interesting series all the way along. The Lightning were better on the power play for sure. Florida, most of the way through, was better at even strength. But at the same time, it's your matchups, you know, that matter. For example, McDonough and Chernak played against Barkov, and for me, Barkov's one of the best centers in the game. I mean, he truly is a dominant guy. He had 3 even strength points in the entire series. He was -8, so they did a number on him. And Huberdeau was the guy actually that was hurting the Lightning more than anybody else, and it showed in the point totals. But I thought McDonough and Chernak did a remarkable job, and of course, you know, the goaltender's in there too, Vasilevsky. So a lot of interesting things, really rough series. I mean, really rough. I watched that Montreal-Toronto game, that last game. I thought, holy mackerel. I mean, that's about 1/10 of the hitting. I mean, it wasn't even close physically to what the Lightning and Florida were doing. It was a punishing, really rough series. And game 1 of that series was one of the most fun games I've ever done on television, man. It had everything. Speed, in-your-face stuff, goal scoring. It was crazy good.
You know, Brian, we talk about the Battle of Alberta. We talk about the Battle of Ontario. This is the first time we've ever talked about the Battle of Florida. Right. What kind of news did this make out in the state of Florida? Because, like I said, this is the first time we've ever seen it.
It was terrific. You know, the true fans, especially for both teams, have been anticipating this for a really long time. I think they both responded really well. I was actually really surprised at how crazy the fans in Florida got. I know what the fans here are like in Tampa. We've seen it. And, of course, going all the way and winning the cup last year, even though it was in the bubble, it was in the atmosphere, in the city. Here in Tampa, over the last probably 4 or 5 years, I mean, the city knows they have a really good team, and there certainly have been their disappointments, but really probably you can go back all the way to when they went to the finals against Chicago and lost to Chicago. And then the disappointments after that at different levels. But the fan base is really big and really true. So the Florida side of it surprised me a little bit. They were crazy and they were having fun. And it just added to the flavor. The whole state, I think, really got into it.
Brian Engblom is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Saturday morning. We're live on our YouTube channel and all of our social media feeds. you know, Brian, you look up and down the Lightning lineup and it's, you know, name player after name player after name player. Yet each and every playoffs, they seem to have somebody sort of come up that nobody's heard of and nobody expects them to necessarily have the impact that they have. Ross Colton would probably have been that guy in the first round against the Panthers. He gets two goals. I'll be honest, he was not a name that was at the tip of my tongue when I was thinking about, you know, impact players for the Lightning in this series. You know, who is Ross Colton and what is the role that he's playing for this Tampa Bay Lightning team?
He's done a terrific job. He's a very skilled young man who's a quick study, and that's probably the best way to describe him. He put in his time in the American League. He learned the game at the pro level. They really got on him. He played 2 years in Syracuse, and they got on him prior to last season for sure and said, hey, you want to get to the NHL? You have to be a better skater, plain and simple. You just have to be better. And so he really took it to heart. He's a really good skater now. Took all that power skating and really put in the effort both in the gym and the technique of the skating as well. And so now it matched his hands and his head because he does have a really good head for the game. Now he was playing with the Gord line for a while when Barclay Goodrow was still injured. And he did a heck of a job there, because he does have the speed and he has the intelligence, and he was getting some more ice time. And what really shocked me is he scored a couple of goals even at the end of the season where I went, oh, man. I mean, Stamkos would have been proud of that wrist shot that he just scored on. Got some really good hands that startled me, quite frankly. And I think when you're a young guy like that, you're not known around the league, especially by the opposing goalies. You know, so when a Stamkos or a Kucherov comes down on the goalie, they're like, okay, we're ready for something. Sometimes these young guys like Colton can really pull the trigger and surprise somebody. And I think Ross Colton did that. I think it's onward and upward for him. He'll be probably fourth line wing. And that's an important thing, because I think in this Carolina series, you're going to need four lines going. They really go at a high pace. Carolina does. And they will use their four lines. So, I mean, if he can score some goals playing with Maroon and Tyler Johnson, it could be a real difference maker in games.
Brian Engblom, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're talking about the Tampa Bay Lightning. The Lightning through to the second round. They're going to face the Carolina Hurricanes in game one, which I believe is tomorrow, sort of late afternoon, early evening in Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, with the Hurricanes being the number one seed.
Right.
You know, Brian, before we get into that series, I want to just think back to that first game. You talked about the energy level, and you played 650-plus games in the NHL, so you know what it's like. You played in Montreal, so you know what fans can do. How much of a difference? Because here in the North, I mean, Montreal, this is the first time in 444 days that there's going to be fans in a Canadian building when there's 2,500 folks in Montreal. What element is that adding? Because I watched that Nashville-Carolina overtime. And what a difference between that overtime and the Montreal-Toronto overtime that same night.
Yeah, I feel bad for all the Canadian teams. It's unfortunate, and I'm sure they watch these games in the U.S. and go, geez. I mean, it's a difference maker for sure. The players here have talked about it, and it energizes you, you know, at the right time. And even if you're the road team, just that extra energy that the fans provide. I think last year, the teams learned how to sort of manufacture energy by themselves. I think they were extra vocal and talked to each other and celebrated sort of even more, you know, when a goal was scored, because the fans weren't there to do it for them. So this year, they said right away, I know our guys here in Tampa were just like, oh, it's so good to have them back. Look, we're in the entertainment business, right? We want fans around. This is why we play. So it does make a huge difference. I'm glad that at least, you know, you get him some fans in Montreal for this game coming up. That's a great thing. And I'm sure they're looking forward really quickly to getting up into the 10, 12, whatever, 1,000 level that the governments will allow as soon as possible.
You know, Brian, you know, just sort of a bit of an aside, but if I'm not mistaken, you played for the Montreal Canadiens the last time prior to this year they faced the Toronto Maple Leafs in the playoffs back in 78-79. You know, what do you remember from that series? Obviously, it would have been the you know, the focus of the entire Canadian hockey world, the Habs and the Leafs. So just, you know, if you remember, if you can sort of share any thoughts that from playing, you know, the last time the Habs and the Leafs played against each other prior to this playoffs.
I'll be honest with you, I don't remember a lot of the details of the series, but I just remember that, I mean, they had some of the who's who of, you know, of the NHL too, as did we, of course, on our Montreal team. But when you're playing against, you know, Sittler and McDonald and Boreas Salming and those guys, that it's really something, you know, some fabulous names. And they had a good team. They just weren't quite as good as our team was. That was the last of the four cups in a row. We played them. That was the first round. And I was racking my brain the other day because I've heard so much about this because it was such a long time ago, the last that the two teams met, that another Winnipeg boy, Cam Connor, was playing for us, right? And I think it was that last game. And he scored the tying goal. All I remember is that Cam told me afterwards that he said he sat on the bench there for a long stretch. And then Bowman called his name and goes, get out there, or tapped him on the back. That's what it was. Tapped him on the back, get out of there. And Cam, like on the fly to get out there. And Cam literally turned around to him and said, no, you touched me. You probably meant someone else. And he went, get out there. Cam scored a big goal. He came flying down off the wing. I don't know how long it had been since he had played, but I remember him telling me that. He said, I come in off the wing. I think it was Pommettier in goal. And he must have come out about 12, 14 feet, which he did a lot of the time. Cam faked the shot, went to make a move, and he kind of, my recollection is he kind of lost it, but it went right underneath Pommettier, who was out of the net. He picked it up on the other side and tapped it into a virtually empty net for a big goal for us. And so he'd been sitting there all this time, thinks he's being tapped on the back by mistake, and then goes out and scores a big goal. So that's one of the things that sticks out in my memory. It was really a case of course, the two cities. I mean, even the French-English thing back then, you know, it was really big. It was hotly contested on so many different levels. And for us, of course, you know, it was great for us. We just moved onward and upward. And for Toronto, they were done at, after the series.
You know, Brian, focusing on the next series for the Tampa Bay Lightning, how do you see them matching up against Carolina? Is this going to be just an unbelievable series? And, you know, obviously, with both teams having a good chance to be a Stanley Cup winner at the end of this?
Carolina is a really good team. They are really good. The numbers are extremely even for both teams, including basically, they sawed it off. They won four games apiece. Nedeljkovic played three of the games. I think he was 2-1, and he was darn good, really good. And for me, Carolina, over the last couple of years, their question mark has always been, is their goaltending going to be consistent enough? Can Reimer do it? Can Mrazek do it? Are they going to use a duo? And, you know, on and on and on. But this kid has come on, and he seems like he's their guy right now. We could see Mrazek somewhere along the line if the kid's having a problem, but I know Nedeljkovic played really well against the Lightning. Carolina is a very fast team. They're an excellent transition team. They can forecheck like few teams in the league. I mean, they get on you fast and hard with all five guys. But then they'll also change it up a bit and sit back. I've seen them do it in the second periods a couple of times. Maybe that strategy so they don't get guys caught. And so it kind of has you kind of, you know, okay, are they coming or are they not coming? Then they turn the pucks over in the neutral zone, and that transition game is what kills you. I think their forwards are very underrated. Sebastian Aho is a hell of a player. That guy is a player, I'm telling you. Both ends of the ice, he is really good. Tara Vinen is a great playmaker. Svechnikov is one of those guys. You take your eyes off him for a second, he's going to kill you. But what I love is the 1-2-3 matchup at center. You got Aho on the first line, you got Trocheck on the second, and you got Stahl on the third. So for the Lightning, you've got Braden Point, and you've got Cirelli, and you got Gord on the third line. So those three lines, not just the centers, but I love the center matchup at 1-2-3 all the way up and down. These lines really can mirror each other. They can do exactly the same types of things to you. And to me, it'll be really interesting at the end of the night. Special teams always matter, no doubt about that. The Lightning power play was simply outstanding against Florida. They'll need to do that again. Carolina took quite a few penalties, as did the Lightning in the first round. So that'll be a factor, as it always is. But who's going to have the points at the end? I think if Sebastian Aho and Dougie Hamilton have a ton of points at the end of the series, then Carolina will have won. And if it's Braden Point or Kucherov and Victor Hedman that really dominating, have a ton of points, then I think the Lightning will have won. But I see that as two guys on each team that really are going to matter.
Was the big trade deadline acquisition for the Lightning, as to be expected, an adjustment period to rejoin a new team. How has he started to sort of fit in? I noticed he's playing, you know, sort of the fifth most minutes, among the Lightning, the defense through the first round. You know, Hedman and McDonough, Sergachev and Chernak are really leading the way. Then there's a pretty big drop off to David Savard. Are you seeing signs that he's maybe becoming more comfortable in his role with the Tampa Bay Lightning?
Yeah, I think he is. It's definitely been a process. They've tried to find what the right fit is. He's played with everybody. He started off with Victor Hedman, only played really one game. And, you know, and that was unfair because it was one of the worst games all year for the Lightning and for Victor Hedman. Victor got caught up the ice about five times. There were two on one. It was a nightmare. I felt bad for Savard. His first game was a disaster, and it wasn't his fault. So then they put him with McDonough. And Victor Hedman's not easy. He's not your orthodox player. He's a very modern defenseman, right? Highly skilled. You let Victor do whatever he wants because he can. And so you have to read off of him because he'll fly right across to your side and blow a team up, you know, defensively in the neutral zone. And you go, where did he come from? Right? So it's unorthodox. Savard, I don't think, was ready for that. So they put him with McDonough, who's a very sort of classic style, skate forwards up, skate backwards back, receive the rush kind of guy. And that's more what Savard is like. Now, that worked pretty well. But I think Savard had trouble getting used to the style that the Lightning play. The Lightning like to jam in the neutral zone. They are good at it. And Savard and his team in Columbus didn't do it that much. They even back off the blue line. It wasn't that hard to get over the blue line against Columbus. They relied on their back checkers to get back and help out in the middle of the ice. We'll give you the zone if you want, but try and get into the middle. Right? That's kind of the way they play. So he's been used to that for years. Lightning don't do that. So it was uncomfortable for him, right? I mean, McDonough and Chernak and those guys, they stand up at the red line, sometimes at the offensive blue line. So they're jamming. I think he always had that, I don't like this feeling, you know? So when the series came up against Florida, I thought it was really intelligent. They moved him with Sergachev and McDonough and Chernak went back together because they were going to match up against Barkov, and you don't want let Barkov over the blue line easily. Mm-hmm. And you need both guys to stand up in order for it to work, right? So you can't have just one doing it and the other guy off the line. So I think that's why he moved back to the Sergachev combo. And so, you know, they spotted him in and he penalty killed and all those things, made some really good plays. I think that made him more comfortable, but I think there's still more there. And the process really, to me, is still ongoing. He's been good, but I think he can even get better. And the more reps he has, I think he will.
Brian Engblom is a Tampa Bay Lightning analyst. The Lightning and the Hurricanes. Game one of that series goes tomorrow, late afternoon. Brian, always appreciate your time. Always appreciate your insight. Nice to see you. We'll do it again real soon, buddy.
Absolutely, guys. Enjoy the playoffs. Thanks for having me.
There he goes. Brian Engblom. Always appreciate hearing from our good friend, Brian Engblom.
Winnipegger. Dave Manuk,
sorry, what were you going to say?
A Winnipegger,
of course. And, you know, it's a fortuitous timing to have Brian on, be able to ask him about that old Leafs-Habs series.
How good is that knowledge? I mean, that's why you love talking to guys like Brian, because they have that insight and he can remember. I mean, he played in the game. So it's not like he just remembered it because he was watching from the sidelines. He was actually in the last Leafs-Habs series. So real good resource. Always love talking to Brian.
Exactly right. We miss him here in Winnipeg, you know, a former staple of our the broadcast back in the day. Dave Minuk, let's go with some final thoughts, focusing on the Jets special teams versus the Leafs and the Habs as we wrap up this Saturday's program. I mean, the Jets had a 30% success rate in the first round, which is a very good success rate. The lowest number of power play opportunities, though, when you look at compared to the Oilers, the Leafs, and the Habs. So that was certainly good that the Jets succeeded, but do they need to draw more penalties in the second round? I mean, the Jets, as I said, only 10 power play opportunities. The Oilers, if I recall correctly, had 11 against the Jets. The Leafs have had 17 power play opportunities in their five games so far, and the Habs have had 14 power play opportunities so far. The Habs 0-for on their power play, 0 goals for in the 14 power play opportunities against the Leafs. Sort of your thoughts on the special teams battle for round two against whomever it will end up being.
Sorry, I'm trying to keep it together, but as you just sent the text, and I made the mistake of looking at it, so I probably shouldn't have. Sometimes it's fun to see if we can get the other guys to laugh on the show, and he got me on that one. So
I've blocked them via text a long time ago, so it makes my life a lot easier.
Okay, well done. So Drew, can you reset that question, because
sure.
I made the mistake of looking down. Ginsburg got me this time.
I'll tell you what: if there's a puffy dog in the corner, don't look at the puffy dog either. The question was about the special teams battle for round two. I was saying the Jets had success in their limited power play opportunities. 3 goals.
No, I heard that power play opportunities. What was the question?
My question is just sort of about the how impactful the special teams battle will be in the second round, be it against the Leafs or be it against the Montreal Canadiens.
Well, I think it's important, obviously. And when you have Nikolaj Ehlers back and you have that second unit in significant quotes, there's no doubt about it that they can produce if given the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And to your point, there weren't 21 penalties in total. And you're saying that the Leafs have had 17, right? Now they've obviously played one more game, but still that's a pretty big number.
Yeah.
You don't want to be taking penalties. I mean, the Leafs have enough power, I think it was
despite their power play struggles over the last, 2-3 months, which are hard to believe truly, you still don't want to necessarily give them give them the catalyst to start going.
You don't want to wake up a sleeping giant. And right. I think it's interesting because that's what Paul Maurice was talking about when he was asked about challenging for whether it was an offside or a goalie interference. And he said, I'm not giving those guys, I mean, Edmonton had 5-on-3s, but I think it was a 5-on-3. One of the challenges he would have had to done was with, I think, 1:46 left in the first penalty. So they would have had a 5-on-3. Because if I'm giving them a 5-on-3 for that long, they're scoring a goal and that 4-1 game is out of reach. So it's interesting the thought process that's going into some of these decisions that are being made on the bench from the Jets coaching staff, well, from all coaching staffs, really. And I mean, I don't think it's rocket science, Drew. I think it's just a function of you just don't want to give Toronto opportunities. They do have the weapons. And talk about getting guys going. I mean, there's nothing better than playing 5-on-4 and having an opportunity for success, because that could sometimes lead to 5-on-5 success. We've seen that before, where guys get a little confidence because they start to get a little bit of mojo courtesy of the power play. Mm-hmm. And we saw what a power play goal did for the Winnipeg Jets in a 4-1 game. Matthew Perreault, I mean, look how, Marat talked about it in the first hour. Look how animated he was when he scored that goal and went to the bench. Now, he's an energy guy anyways, so he'll always be up to amp up the team. But it's an opportunity that you just can't afford. And the Jets PK is solid, but you just don't need to be allowing these guys to get in games. And especially if they're struggling 5-on-5, why give them that opportunity?
You're absolutely right. Since March 1st, and this is only looking at the regular season games, the Toronto Maple Leafs have the 30th power play in the NHL, operating at just over 10%. So you look at they've certainly been struggling, certainly at least since March. You know, the Montreal Canadiens, they haven't scored a power play goal in their opportunities in the playoffs. Thus far, the Jets had some success, not a lot of chances. 30% success rate, though, you'll probably take that, each and every series, no questions asked. Yes, I see Jeff in the chat room saying 30th. I know it's hard to believe. The Toronto Maple Leafs, I just want to confirm this, since March 1st, from March 1st through the end of the regular season, a grand total of 34 hockey games have a success rate of 10%, which is 30th in the NHL. They've been better a little bit so far in the playoffs. So you know, buyer beware, but that is worth noting that it's hard to believe that a team with that much firepower has struggled so seriously on the power play. Dave, we're going to be back on this week. Yes. We don't know when it's going to be. We don't know if it's going to be Tuesday night. We don't know yet if it's going to be Thursday night. I mean, it's likely to be one of those two, I would assume. It depends what happens tonight between the Leafs and the Habs. So if that game, if that series ends tonight, I think we'll know by we'll know immediately after the game when game one of the Jets and Leafs series would be. We'll keep you posted, everybody. Best thing you can do, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Follow us on Twitter. If you're not doing both of those things already, I'm not sure what you're waiting for. Just click the button. While you're at it, click the thumbs up button. And you know, we'll let you know as soon as we are live back for the Illegal Curve post-game show. I still can't get over, Dave, on Tuesday morning when it was 1:45, 2 a.m., that there were 500-plus people joining us in the chat room from all around the world. I mean,
there were 800 plus after game three. It was insane.
Well, game three, but at least game three was at a reasonable hour.
And it was a
holiday the next day. Game four was, you know, in the middle of the freaking night. Well, and people from Austria, the Netherlands, our buddy Rowdy, Australia, Thailand, Singapore, Thailand, London. I mean, we had people all around North America, all around the world.
Some people from North Kildonan.
North Kildonan, the wild, exotic parts of North Kildonan. We want to see that continue into round two. And we're going to go live, of course. We're going to be here to support you. We'll be your outlet once the second round of the playoffs begin.
So us be and Kenny and Rennie.
And Kenny and Rennie after us as well, of course. Keep it locked.
Oh, wait, so if we Drew, we were down at 2:30-ish, 2:15, yeah. 2:30, whatever it was. I mean, I saw that they were on, and I thought to myself, may God have mercy. And they must have gone until about 4.
Well, I mean,
at least 3:30 or 4 o'clock.
As Sean has said before, you know, Ken has got a little more what I'm going to call flexibility. He doesn't have necessarily the same family obligations that I have, that Ezzy has, you know, that Sean has, that you have in some respects. So Kenny doesn't mind going until the wee hours. Kenny's a night owl. You're a night owl. It took me about a good couple days of some early bedtimes to recover from the Tuesday morning late night Illegal Curve post game show. But hey, Sandy, she got 1 hour of sleep that night.
That's hardcore.
Sandy, you are a legend. You are a warrior being able to keep that up. Al from Long Beach, California, we always appreciate you guys joining us wherever you may be around the world. That's the beauty of this format. You know, we get to have the interaction. You can just click a button, and it doesn't matter if you're in Winnipeg, if you're in North Kildonan, if you're in Transcona, or if you're in Thailand, or you're in the Netherlands. We're going to be here, you're going to be here, and it's going to be a fun time with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on Saturday mornings and the Illegal Curve post-game show after each and every Winnipeg Jets game.
Well, let's not forget, though, the Jets content doesn't end, Drew, because even though the show's going to end,
yes,
if you go to illegalcurve.com, we're going to have a practice report, we're going to have the post-game podcast, we've already got the morning papers, there is a ton of Jets news on illegalcurve.com right now, we've got all the media availability from the entire week. So you can get caught up on everything. So make sure you go to illegalcurve.com, check out all the content. And again, we're going to have, well, there's not going to be a lot of time, time to relax, because I'm going to get off of here with you. And then we're going to flip this thing over and start doing Jets media availability, which probably will be in about half an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not seeing anything, I don't think I've seen anything tweeted. So I'm not sure if there's anything that's going on right now that's terribly exciting and worth even reporting from Bell MTS Place.
Exactly what my point was going to be. Exactly. The Jets allegedly hit the ice about 30 minutes ago for their practice, which is going to be probably very similar to the practice they had yesterday and very similar to the practice they had the day before. The fact that I'm not seeing any tweets at all is probably a reasonable sign that there's not a lot going on from Jets practice. But whatever it is, you know that it will be available on illegalcurve.com. Want to give a big shout out to our sponsors. They make this show possible. Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, Boston Pizza, our good friends at Seagram's and Lynn's Heating, Cooling, Sewer, and Drain. Thanks to all of these great sponsors for making the Illegal Curve Hockey Show possible. We do recommend you support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. For Ezra Ginsberg, who's been in the chat the entire time despite not being
able to join us.
And texting us, so don't even ask about that. For Dave Manuk, I am your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on our YouTube channel and all of our social media platforms.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.